Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
In this episode, Trishul and Aaron discuss more ways the U.S. tax system helps the wealthy. Qualified small business stock, self-directed IRAs, and grantor retained annuity trusts are all legal means by which rich people can sidestep millions or potentially billions in taxes. But these are not just random loopholes. Now corporations can legally spend unlimited sums of money lobbying politicians to write laws that favor, you guessed it, the wealthy. That's why it makes fiscal sense for a corporation to spend $1 billion lobbying to save $10 billion in taxes. In the end, if we think income inequality is a big deal, the first step to change is to understand how easy it is for the wealthy to avoid paying their fair share. And now, on to our conversation.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area. And I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today, and thanks everybody for listening.
Great to be here as well. Last week, we talked about the tax structure in the United States and how the structure itself and the system itself contributes to income inequality. And Trishul had brought up kind of a few, but wait, there's more. And just kind of piling on of like all these little things that contributed to those inequalities, and got a little upset that I kind of cut him off. So he had some more things that we want to go deeper into. And these are just more and more examples of how the tax system in the US hurts income earners and helps the wealthy. And so Trishul, what was the kind of next thing on your list that you wished we could have gotten to last week, but we ran out of time? That when we look at just how the tax structure and how the systems and how the codes are set up to unfortunately hurt regular income earners and help the wealthy.
Right. So before I dig into the specifics, I just want to highlight the discrepancy between individuals who might be on the lower end of this distribution in terms of wealth or income versus individuals on the other end, just to provide a little bit of context of what we're talking about. Here's an analogy. So imagine we have steps, and each step represents a certain level of wealth, where the bottom step means you're kind of broke. And if you start going towards the basement, you kind of owe money. But let's say you want to make it to the very first step on this staircase that goes pretty high up, and call this staircase $100,000. So to get to the very first step, you would need to have $100,000 of wealth. Well, it turns out most Americans won't even make it past the ground floor. They won't make it to the first step. Kind of, we've explored that notion before. But then kind of compare that to individuals who are kind of wealthy. Well, they might be on the fifth step. That'd be the 80th percentile. So basically, 80% of the population is below the fifth step on the staircase. And then just to kind of crunch those numbers home, your billionaire is on the 10,000th step. And what that kind of means is that's about five Empire State Buildings. And then you think about individuals like Jeff Bezos, you know, whose wealth is far greater than even that. Well, he's about halfway to the distance to the International Space Station. So you can see how individuals who are walking around on the flat surface of Earth, you might not even be able to see somebody's wealth if it was compared in this way. And now to just provide some analysis on what's kind of going on here. We've mentioned before that the incomes of individuals across different stages of income, meaning people who earned little many years ago, end up earning less today, a generation later. These same types of jobs are paying, or same types of income percentage earners are earning less, whereas the wealthy are earning a lot greater percentage today than they used to. And again, what we tied into all of this is a few points in the last episode, how taxes seem to make a big difference, especially given that we've highlighted many ways where you can amass great amounts of wealth, but have your tax burden be quite low. Mm-hmm. Even though the goal of the tax system is to be progressive, meaning the more wealth you have, the more you would be taxed, it seems like the opposite may be happening in many cases. And there are many examples that we reviewed in the last episode of how this is possible. So here are a few more.
This reminds me a little bit of, there's actually an episode on West Wing a long time ago where they're trying to explain why a progressive tax system makes sense, and a little bit of that, the morality of it. But they use the phrase veil of ignorance. The idea is that if you're designing this system, you have to kind of pretend that you're, from the day you're born, you don't know what your future income will be, and no one knows what their future income will be. How would you design a tax system that's fair? And that's the idea behind the progressive tax brackets, that it seems if you do make that much more money, that it does feel fair to the society in whole. But you're saying that, unfortunately, it's not necessarily fair, that there are those who are that much higher at the halfway to the International Space Station level that just aren't paying their podcast fair share.
Right. And there are simple examples that we've already discussed, such that the hiring of the estate tax exemption amount or the gift tax exemption amount of being close to over 20 million now. There's also things for people who own businesses compared to income earners. We mentioned the qualified small business stock exemption. And Aaron, you had kind of talked about this before as well. Do you want to give a highlight of that?
So I was doing this as part of our stock options conversation, where if you own stock in a company that's valued at less than $50 million, so this tends to be founders and maybe the first dozen employees, and that stock grows and has an IPO, if you hold it for at least 5 years, and lots of the caveats, you have to actually own the stock, you can't own options, that may qualify for qualified small business stock, where if you meet all of the IRS rules, all of the capital gains in that stock are tax-free, up to $10 million. So you could have the situation where a founder of a company sells their company, they make $10 million and don't pay any taxes on it. Now, again, there's a lot of risk involved. It requires putting their own personal time and money and capital in at the beginning. So from the employee's perspective, it's, do you buy the stock? Do you exercise these options years in advance when you have no idea if this company's going to be profitable? Are you willing to take on that personal investment risk? And that's the theory behind why they provide this QSBS, is that if you're willing to take on that such a huge investment risk, the tax system is set up where, okay, we'll give you some kind of reward for that. You could have bought stock in a publicly traded company, but instead you took on this investment risk, you helped grow the company, you kind of help the company create new jobs, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, you could get up to $10 million tax-free. And for serial entrepreneurs and founders and some in the kind of venture capital world, you can also roll over those gains from one qualified small business to another qualified small business. And there's, again, very complex, lots of rules. But there is the system in place where you can get up to $10 million and have it be completely tax-free. And that's a number that doesn't feel like it's just trying to help out regular people.
Yeah, that would be far higher than the fifth step, which is the 80th percentile, 500,000.
So yeah.
It seems like if you're benefiting from that and you end up paying zero in tax on 10 million in income, it's all growth and capital gains, but this is what you've earned from the company. Zero might be a low tax rate. Just one example, but let's move on to the next one because we got a few of these. And this one has to do with IRAs. So we mentioned in the past, the government set up these individual retirement accounts to provide incentives for the American taxpayer to get some sort of benefit so that they save more for retirement. Now, the contribution limits each year are like 6,000-7,000 if single, and double that if you're married. So over time, we've mentioned if you just save that 6,000-7,000, you and your wife each year over the course of your career, you could have a solid retirement over, 45 years, a couple million.
Max out your Roth IRA, you get 8%, 9%, 10% rate of return, and you have $1 million.
Yeah. So not so bad. But then what was kind of noticed when Senator Mitt Romney was running for president back in the early 2010s, he had to disclose his financials as part of a federal disclosure requirement. And in his IRA, he had an IRA that ranged from 20 to 100 million. And a lot of people were scratching their heads thinking, well, first of all, how did a person get a retirement account of this size if the contribution amount is so low? And we don't know exactly how he was able to pull it off, but there are some theories, and there are ways to do it where you can get quite a lot into your IRA by following some rules that the standard taxpayer won't likely follow. And what this has to do with is the notion of having a self-directed IRA, meaning you can have an IRA where you invest with your standard brokerage and invest in stocks and mutual funds and things like that. But also, it turns out you can invest in other more exotic things if you wish. And this could be what Mitt Romney did to get his IRA to grow to that size. Now, what the government does allow is for you to invest in private equity, for example. However, the government has a special tax if you do try to go down this road, because the government realizes that you may be able to have exemptions in your IRA that aren't available to other people, and that might provide an unfair competitive advantage. So the government says, okay, if you want to invest in private equity, we're going to charge you this other tax. It's a UBIT tax.
UBIT?
Yeah, UBIT.
Okay.
So with the UBIT tax, basically the government is saying, well, you're going to have to pay a good amount of tax if you want to invest in private equity, something where you're going to probably get a higher rate of return. This is a unrelated business income tax.
Okay.
Now, the tax rate is pretty high, around 30-35%, but there's a way around this tax rate. If you invest your self-directed IRA into an offshore company, and that offshore company invests in a private equity, you've just gone around the UBIT tax, and you don't have to pay anything in UBIT tax. So here we go. Here's another way where this is likely somebody on the plus fifth step taking advantage of something that somebody on the bottom step will not likely able to do.
So this reminds me of when you said self-directed IRA, I usually see that from people who ask about buying real estate or buying an individual rental property in their IRA. And technically it's possible. And the idea there is that if you have saved up a few hundred thousand dollars in your 401k at work, you roll that over to an IRA, you could do it, again, a self-directed IRA. That money could be the down payment on the rental property. And you can also, you could even get a mortgage, so you can leverage those dollars, usually at the scale of 5 to 1. That'd be a 20% down payment. For rental properties, depending on the lender, you might need a 30% down payment. But you could have the situation where the rental income's paying the mortgage. You're just getting the benefits of the leverage from that rental property. Some of the risks come into play that, again, oversimplifying, but you can only pay expenses related to that property from dollars inside the IRA. That it has to kind of be self-contained. If it is vacant, you have to pay your mortgage from cash inside the IRA. You can't use your own personal cash to make the mortgage payment. Property taxes, maintenance, if the roof breaks and you need to pay for that, then that also comes from cash inside the IRA. Because if you try to use outside money, you're violating some of the rules related to self-directed IRAs. The investments have to be wholly contained within those IRAs. So I do try to explain to sometimes clients, sometimes prospective clients or others, that you can buy real estate in an IRA, but the risk's going to be worth it. You have to kind of keep a large enough cash position to cover those risks, that the return's not as much as you think it is, and you also lose some of the tax benefits of owning real estate, chiefly depreciation. When you own real estate outright, you can take advantage of depreciation on your taxes, but you don't get to inside the self-directed IRA. But I do like that you're introducing the concept that just there are things such as self-directed IRAs that allow you to make investments in things other than publicly traded stocks and bonds and mutual funds and ETFs. And the idea of kind of having an IRA at an offshore account and avoiding that UBIT does feel like something that only applies to, again, people above that fifth or tenth step.
You know, so far, everything we've said is kind of completely legal. It's all in the tax code. And it maybe it's hidden away, maybe not, but it's these things that individuals beyond a certain level on the staircase will likely take advantage of. Next thing I want to consider is, we've mentioned corporate taxes in the past, and part of the discussion in the past was that corporate taxes have gone down in the recent administration because of the concern that they weren't competitive with other parts of the world. And part of the initial concern, though, is the corporate tax rate has been higher. And there's this notion of double taxation, meaning when a corporation earns income, the corporation is taxed. And then once the corporation declares a dividend, well, then the person receiving the dividend is taxed. So then on that income generated by the firm, well, now it's taxed twice. And if you add those two together, you get a pretty high rate. But we've mentioned in the past how there are ways to circumvent this. For the dividend itself, the company could issue buybacks and then kind of push that dividend back into the company, allowing the stock price to go up. And then if you don't sell the stock for a long time, you get tax deferred growth on that dividend, in air quotes. And we also mentioned the notion that a corporation can just not show income by first taking money that it receives as revenue and spending it on expansion. Mm-hmm. So that the bottom line ends up being zero year after year. We also mentioned this notion that a corporation with enough size, a larger company, can start to be a little more creative and start booking revenue in different places around the world while keeping the expenses in the US.
Yeah.
So one thing that was studied is, if you look at the tax rates, the effective tax rates, again, not the marginal tax rates, meaning the tax on the next dollar earned, but the weighted average of all the taxes these companies pay, and you look at them over time, you notice an interesting pattern. So one thing that was studied is looking at the effective tax rate of the top 10% largest companies in terms of revenue versus the bottom 90% of companies in terms of revenue and looking at their effective tax rates. Now, if we had a progressive tax system or even a kind of even across the board tax system, it wouldn't matter if you were large or small, you would pay the same tax rate. But if it was progressive, if you were a larger company and you had more profits, you might pay a higher rate. And interestingly enough, this was true in the 70s. So back then, if you were a top 10% company in terms of revenue, your effective tax rate was higher, around 37% for the corporate tax rate versus 34% for a smaller company. And this is 1970 to 1974. However, you look at this recent period, 2015 through 2018, if you're one of these larger companies, top 10% of the largest companies in terms of revenue, your effective tax rate is 28%. But if you're a smaller company, your effective tax rate is 41%.
Whoa.
Now, you know, let's scratch our heads. How can a progressively designed tax system work out so that larger companies end up paying less in tax?
So the first question I think of when kind of just skepticism applied to various studies, I wonder how many of those top 10% largest companies are truly multinational, like they actually do generate a large percentage of their revenue outside the US versus the smaller companies that might be domestic only. So that is one thing that comes to mind.
That's a good point. One notion in general is as you get larger, you have a better ability to scale and more likely you would be international just for that reason. While in addition, being allowed to MBA 101, put more price pressure and grow more effectively and be more efficient and things like that. But at the end of the day, this was just looking at all the countries and kind of segmenting based upon that. However, what they did also look at is how did effective foreign tax rates compare over time? So we can kind of add that in as another data point, which might add a little more color to, Aaron, your particular concern. So segmenting it with this in line, so adding a few more numbers. So looking at the early 80s now in this chart, it's a different segmentation. For domestic companies, basically companies that just obtain revenue from the US, and looking at them, their tax rate in the 80s, 1984 to 89, if you were a larger company, you're in top 10%, your effective tax rate was 30%. But if you were a smaller company, bottom 90%, your effective tax rate was 43%.
So in the 80s, domestic companies, larger ones had effective 30, small ones had a 43. So in that decade from the 70s to the 80s, the top 10% dropped from 37 to 30, while the bottom 90% increased from an effective rate of 34% to 43%.
Right.
Yeah.
So okay. Already there, you're not seeing something progressive, it's regressive. Now, let's compare companies with foreign revenue in that period. So the effective foreign tax rate for that 80s period for larger companies was 47%, so higher. So instead of 30%, if you had foreign revenue, you were paying a 47% tax if you were one of these larger companies.
Huh.
If you were a smaller company, you were paying 40%. So instead of 43, 40, maybe call it about the same if you were a smaller company. However, let's look at the later period, or the more recent period, that is 2010 to 2018, here you see something a little bit different. So if you're a domestic company or domestic revenue and you're a large company, you're paying 34% about what you paid in 1984, a little bit higher, 31 to 34. And for the smaller companies, it did actually go up. It went from 43% to 50%. So really, really regressive. Now, a lot of people are saying that, yeah, tax rates for corporations are high. And if you're a smaller company, that might be true. But if you're a larger company, even if your revenue is domestic, you seem to be doing a little bit better here. Now scratch your head on why that might be the case.
I'm guessing it's they have the ability to hire CPAs and lawyers more effectively, and the expense of those CPAs and those accountants and lawyers is significantly less than saving 16% of their revenue on taxes.
Yeah, if you're talking billions of dollars, you can hire an army of lawyers for
yeah.
And we'll get to this in probably a later conversation, but also lobbying money as it pertains to Citizens United. So that's probably a bigger conversation, but that likely plays into all this as well.
Do you want to give a really quick primer on Citizens United, that the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah. Okay, happy to. What used to happen, this was actually about 10 years ago, there used to be this distinction on how much money you could contribute to a campaign, and there's contribution limits. However, there was a ruling, Citizens United versus the Federal Election Commission in 2010-ish. But basically, it said that corporations could contribute an unlimited amount to the benefit of a client, or sorry, a candidate, Freudian slip, I guess, to the point where as long as they're not contributing directly to that campaign, they could still contribute an unlimited amount if the money didn't flow directly to that particular politician.
So going through PACs and super PACs.
Right, exactly. These things known as PACs and super PACs. So basically that opened the floodgates for potentially any amount of money, because corporations, if they want to save $10 billion in tax, could spend $1 billion and make up that money 10x. And a billion can go a long ways in terms of influence a campaign. There's a lot of stuff to talk about with that in particular on its own, in addition to other legislative things that have occurred through lobbying, but that's probably a later conversation.
Okay, so now we're at this case where large companies, even they get their revenue domestically, they're paying effective tax rate of 34%, but smaller companies are paying an effective tax rate of 50%.
Right. Now, what's kind of shifted, though, is previously we mentioned foreign companies were paying around 40 to 47%, large or small.
Yeah.
But recently, in the last 10 years, their tax rates have gone down considerably. They've gone down to 25 to 29%. That's large versus small, respectively. So Basically, it makes sense to book revenue from foreign places if possible.
Okay.
And this has been an ongoing debate, but for example, the IRS finally decided to sue Facebook for part of this, saying that they booked too much revenue, or they got too much in terms of tax deferrals or tax compensation from booking revenue through Ireland. And we mentioned before, if you're a company and you have a lot of expenses and a lot of revenue, more revenue than expenses, you're going to owe a bunch of tax. But if you can somehow show that revenue occurred in a different country, well, all of a sudden you have a lot of expenses and no revenue, you get a loss in the US, and then the revenue in another country, which has a lower tax rate,
Can
come out ahead. The government is now suing Facebook up to $9 billion, saying, hey, that you probably took this a little bit too far. Not that you took it at all, but you maybe took it a little bit too far. So things like this are still possible, and maybe they're taken too far, but even if they weren't, you could still circumvent taxes a good amount by following these types of strategies.
That's a really good kind of eye-opening thing for me, because the theories, the double taxation was concerned mine, the kind of competition with other international tax jurisdictions was concerned mine, but seeing that foreign revenue is already lower than domestic revenue, which kind of makes sense if we're trying to be competitive from a foreign tax perspective. But yeah, that difference between the large companies and the small companies is pretty stark.
Yeah, and if we had a progressive tax system, then you wouldn't see that.
Yeah.
Which kind of shows that either the system is broken or it's working as intended, but not as how likely many people would want if they do.
Yeah. So it's either something's wrong with the actual taxes in terms of what they're designed to be progressive. So they are not progressive. So it's either something wrong with the progression aspect or with the optics of this was how it was designed, but people don't realize it.
Yeah. And the same argument can be said for just, as we mentioned, the change in income inequality over the past generation or two. If our tax system was designed to be progressive, we wouldn't see the top end earners have a much higher growth in wealth. If more money was being spent on the poor to elevate them, then we would see them getting richer over time, in theory, or we would see tax rates for the poor at an effective level lower than tax rates for the rich.
Yeah. So it's not, it is kind of, it's almost compounding the advantages that wealthy have when over regular income earners, people on that first step or on the ground level of just, there's the capital gains and dividends on the individual side, but even at the corporate level, the tax rates are different between those really large companies and regular small businesses.
Yeah, and as we mentioned, the wealthy earn most of their wealth through owning corporations.
Yeah.
But wait, there's more.
Okay, go on.
So then it comes down to what we've decided as a society is, we don't want this to continue over generations, because then if you just end up starting with money, then you get a free lunch your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have or had this notion of estate tax, where if you have $1 billion and you want to pass that to your kids, it gets taxed because we want this ability to not have just generational wealth after generation, where individuals, once they reach a certain wealth level, are indemnified from having to provide anything beyond just sitting back and earning interest or returns on their wealth.
So it's like just that contributing member of society idea that if you only inherit $500 million instead of $1 billion, you can still kind of do whatever you want. And if you want to get back up to that billion, you got to figure out some way to help others and build that wealth back up.
Yeah. And it turns out you can keep your billion and eat it too. So there are notions of different trusts that you can employ that help provide ways to circumvent the ability to have to pay estate tax. And we've talked about these notions of trusts when we looked into estate planning. And the goal with estate planning was to come up with a way so that you can efficiently use the rules to move assets and take care of your loved ones once you pass away. And we mentioned this estate tax exemption amount that used to be around 2 million and then it jumped up to 4 and 5, 6, 7, and now it's 11 million for an individual and 22 million if you're married, 23 million if you're married.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens with billion-dollar estates? Do they really pay 400 million in estate taxes, the 40% rate when an estate transfers to their children? And it turns out that there are, as we've seen with many of the other things we've discussed, there's workarounds so that you can effectively transfer billions without paying estate tax. Now, some things that have come up are, for example, something pulled off by the Walmart family, one of the most wealthiest families in the U.S.
Yeah.
And in fact, they have a trust named after them. So this particular trust is something that was instituted, known as a GRAT trust, G-R-A-T, a grantor retained annuity trust.
Mm-hmm.
And the notion here is there's a way to set up a trust where, say, $1 billion goes into the trust, and the trust holds stock, and the trust has rules that it has to follow. The rules are that it has to pay back money to the person who put in the money.
Mm-hmm.
And then anything excess can be passed on to the heirs as part of their estate. Now you have to pay estate tax on the excess. But if you return enough money to the person who put in the money, then you don't have to pay estate tax on that amount. And let me put this into context. Let's say you put in $1 billion into this GRAT trust. Now the government says, if you end up pulling out $1 billion in some interest over, let's say, 5 years, a couple percent a year, then you don't have to pay any estate tax. But if you end up earning more than that couple percent, that more than couple percent can go to your children without having to pay estate tax.
So if I remember correctly, the idea here is the money you put in, if you happen to put in money into a GRAT and then pass away the next year, that is still included in your estate tax. That kind of, it's locking in the value of those, of that asset at the time you put the money in the trust. So if you didn't have any kind of distribution, which isn't the way it works, or if it only had 1 year of distribution, you still owe estate taxes on that particular value. But if you have enough years where you've distributed, say, 5% over 20 years, then you've reduced that value each year that you would be added to your estate tax. So after 20 years, you've kind of satisfied that. You've taken all that money back out. But if your investments are growing greater than 5%, say they're growing 7 to 10%, just like many other equities, all that growth is considered in the beneficiary's estate.
Yeah.
Does that sound correct?
Yeah, that's the right flavor. So the notion is it's just a way to transfer money without having to pay estate tax. And there are about, I don't know, how many flavors does Carvel have? 35 flavors? Enough flavors per ice cream at Carvel of these different types of trusts so that you can employ one a week and you'd still have enough in time for the end of the summer. And, you know, $1 billion here, $1 billion there, and all over time, you can go pretty far with these types of notions.
Yeah. That is... So it's one of those things of, this is why you got to plan years in advance, because if you do this, it takes a long time. But like you said, you could pass billions of dollars to heirs estate tax-free.
Yeah, so the notion is these are harder to do. They take more foresight. They take complication. But if you have $1 billion, you can outsource this pretty easily.
Yeah.
So you probably don't have to sweat too much.
The team of lawyers, again, costs significantly less than the estate taxes saved.
Right. And from the perspective of the wealthy, they're just following the rules, that they're doing their fiduciary status for their own wealth. They're doing what you're supposed to do. So it's hard to say that they should be doing anything different.
But they may be spending the money in lobbying to influence writing the rules.
Right. And that's where the issues come into play, especially if you are now allowed to contribute, as we mentioned with Citizens United, effectively in an unlimited amount into helping a campaign, air quotes.
Yeah. It's almost depressing. It's all... And he's like, yeah, everything you said makes sense. I have seen it applied a few times. I've even given similar advice to my clients. Like I said, that's the fiduciary thing to do. None of my clients are spending money on lobbying, but we are going to take advantage of the rules that are in place. That is the fiduciary thing to do on behalf of my clients. But I can definitely see how it specifically contributes to income inequality over time, especially over a generation.
Right. We mentioned before, for example, the notion that if you give your kids $1 million instead of paying for their education, would that be beneficial? And we talked about how if you invest $1 million over 45 years, you'll have close to 20 million. And you can see how at that point you could spend 3% rule hundreds of thousands a year and you'd never run out of money.
Yeah. So I do wonder how many people or households this does affect. Like, do you happen to have an idea of how many people are above the 100th step? Or how many people are above even the 10th step?
Right. So the 10th step is $1 million.
Yeah.
So I believe that would probably put you in the 1%. We can check the math later or put in the show notes.
So yeah, I think roughly $1 million might be top 2%. It's definitely not 3%, but yeah, something like that.
Right. And to basically understand that the effective tax rate for individuals above the 10th step could be, if you play your cards right, and there's no reason why you shouldn't, if you can outsource effectively, could be close to nothing.
Yeah.
Now, we as a society want to come up with a tax rate that's fair. We don't want to give handouts to the bottom and hope they don't waste it, and they end up wasting it. It does suck. But at the end of the day, there's a distribution here, and we as a society need to understand, will the pain of helping out the 1% and them wasting it be worse than the pain of giving a free ride to the top 1% and which would be more impactful to the society if we made that, 1% of individuals pay their fair share?
That's a really good point. If we were about helping out the bottom 10% and 1% of them waste it, we're probably even still saving money if we can get the top 1% to pay their fair share, to actually pay a progressive tax.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about dollars versus cents, or billions of dollars versus hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things where there's no ideal system, and there's probably nothing that we can do to make sure that everybody pays the exact same amount, or, a progressive amount, even if we want to go that far. But at the end of the day, there's likely things that we can do that are better if we have the will to do so, which we may not even have. Right? So that's just something to think about.
Yeah. Anything positive you want to try and add before we wrap up?
For our less than 100 steppers or less than 20 steppers, I just try to help my clients as best we can to navigate ourselves to do the things that make sense. And there's plenty you can do in the bottom 20 steps to help you out. And having a good understanding of how the taxes work is pretty important. In fact, in my mind, there are two avenues that people generally take to try to increase their returns and provide a greater return on equity, per se. One is you try to outsmart the market and you try to get a better return than everybody else. And the other is you just try to be efficient and you follow these rules, these tax rules, for example, as best as you can. And I'd say if you do the latter, you have a far greater chance of coming out ahead.
That's true. I do try to emphasize with clients better after-tax returns. One is kind of the laws are there, they're written. We can plan around them. We can focus on the things we can control. The market returns, we can't control. We're just going to see kind of what happens. We can control our asset allocation and our exposure to different asset classes and risk return spectrums. But a lot of the tax strategies, those are things that can control. And that's where we can make a lot of those positive impacts on clients' net worths over time.
Right. Yeah. So, well, I hope I had a chance to get out what I was hoping to. I think at the end of the day, it's just the notion that there probably is more we can do to make taxes more sensible across the board. And hopefully this episode will provide some insight into that.
It does sound like the first step is really perception, is really making sure the general public is aware that these tax laws exist and how the wealthy take advantage of them. Just like they could take advantage of them themselves, but they don't have the money to hire lawyers and they would have to spend too much time and they may not have the money that the ROI just isn't there for them. It doesn't make sense to spend that money on a lawyer when the benefit's not going to be that great, whereas it does make sense for the wealthy. And if enough people are aware that this structure is in place, maybe we as a society decide that's not what we want.
Maybe. That's a hopeful point to end on.
Okay, I like that. So we'll keep working on opening the society's eyes and addressing perception if we're not going to get actual laws changed.
Well, good stuff, Aaron. And I enjoyed the conversation. So thanks, everybody, for listening. If you liked what you heard, feel free to drop us a line. Or if you have any questions, feel free to do the same.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.